So Aristide finished his mandate, and the people again voted for somebody of the Lavalas movement. The Lavalas movement being that huge social movement demanding change, demanding another system, demanding the end of exclusion, the end of apartheid in Haiti. So they voted for Mr. Préval, who had been Aristide's first prime minister and a long political associate of Aristide. Préval did his term, but with enormous difficulty. He was systematically blocked by parliament, in which a number of opposition parties have gained, if not an absolute majority, but enough seats to block every move that the president wanted to make. Despite that, Préval did a couple of things that were of great importance and explain what happened just about a month ago. He turned his attention to the Haitian peasant who had been supporting this country and getting nothing in return. He lowered the price of fertilizer from 70 Haitian dollars to 29. He gave control of the irrigation systems to peasant organization directly. They were the one managing this system. He also put at the disposal of this association farm machinery that were also managed by the peasant association. So the link between Lavalas, which was mostly in the beginning with the urban masses, started also being built with the peasants. He also, as I mentioned, built many public schools and was generally perceived as somebody that was totally non-corrupt, which was a great change from the leaders we'd had before. And he was the first Haitian president to be elected and to finish his term. So we seem to have gotten the hang of it. Aristide was elected, then passed on power to an elected president, and in 2000, Aristide again became a candidate, won the election in the landslide, and Préval handed power to him. That was the third time. So Haitian democracy, the ballot instead of the bullet, seemed to be well established. But Aristide barely assumed office that the destabilization campaign started. Locally, all these myriad of opposition parties refused to recognize his victory, demanded immediately that he step down and that new election be held. And internationally, what happened was that think tanks were formed, a systematic campaign of disinformation was started, you know, making believe that Aristide was the worst dictator, worse even than Duvalier. He was a murderer, he was a drug trafficker, and that's all you heard, you know, when you read the mainstream press and when you read or heard these think tanks named, for example, Haiti Democracy Project, when you heard certain NGOs that were under the influence of these puppet master, and also the armed destabilization started using ex-military, because the army had been disbanded in 1995 by Aristide, and using also ex-member of that death squad that was called FRAP, who was so active during the coup. They would make raids into the country and then go back to the Dominican Republic, of course, with the help and the knowledge of the Dominican army, which means immediately the U.S. to step up the campaign, a new group appeared on the scene, the so-called civil society, or group of 184. It pretended to represent a large array of organization, peasant organization, religious organization, organization of youth, women, etc., etc. But when you really looked at it, you could see that it was a machine that was directed by this 1% that controlled 50% of the wealth. And the leader of that group was the owner of a sweatshop, Mr. Appade. So we knew that, you know, this thing was a machine of the elite, so that it would have the monopoly of political power as well as the monopoly of economic power. And that's what happened. This group stepped onto the scene and started demonstration after demonstration. In the meantime, about 200 men crossed from the DR and started attacking police station, etc. The rest, you know it. On the 9th of February 28 to 29, Canadian Special Forces came to Port-au-Prince, secured the airport, and a plane and a commando from the U.S. landed, took away Aristide. Then the French landed on the very year of the bicentennial of our independence. There ensued, after installing the puppet regime with Mr. Latortue, who was a Haitian who had been living abroad for something like 40 years, he was brought back and installed as prime minister. A president was installed, and immediately this regime started an all-out attempt at crushing Lavalas. All means were employed. Economic repression, the new government, the first thing it did was fire between 4,000 and 5,000 people who had been working in the public sector. This in a country where you have 70% plus unemployment. Second, it unleashed some members of the national police and the ex-military who were incorporated in the police. He unleashed them on the popular neighborhood with countless of assassination, what they call extrajudicial killing. And the jail, which have been emptied and under Aristide had no political prisoners, suddenly were filled with political prisoners, people who were arrested simply because of their political opinion, or worse, for belonging to a certain strata of society, mainly or exclusively the poor people in Port-au-Prince. Their house would be raided by the police and then the minister. In the middle of the night, people were arrested in large number without any warrant. And as we speak of the 1,000 plus prisoners, not 10 have seen a judge. So they are truly political prisoners. So all this repression had only one objective: to really break the back of the Haitian people so that the system that they wanted to install from the beginning, from 1986 on, could finally be installed. So, after breaking the back, or so they thought, of the Haitian people, breaking their spirit, to make sure they prepared what I can only define as a high-tech election to ensure to obtain a people-less democracy, they introduced a biometric card that was produced with computers. And listen to this. This card, which has your picture and your fingerprint, this card, which is a national identity card, was printed in Mexico by a U.S.-owned firm. So this gives you the extent to which our national sovereignty has been completely trampled. The idea was to obtain a decent number of voters, and I've heard foreign diplomat in Haiti said that, you know, they didn't need more than about a tenth of the potential electorate to validate the election. And that's the number they were aiming for. But already at the grassroots level, people were telling another story. You know, the whole idea was, you know, we're not going to participate in this sham election. But other people said, hey, why don't we go and get that card? Because truly they don't want us to get it. We're going to get it, and if need be, we'll boycott the election, but with our card in hand. They won't be able to say that we're not interested in politics because we have registered, but if we boycott, it's because we think these are sham election. And things went like that for a little while, with people going to register, but, you know, without too much enthusiasm, because there was not a single candidate which they really felt any trust. That is until, once again, very late in the process, Préval came out of retirement and declared his candidacy. And immediately, the rate of registration soared, and it was clear that something was amiss. The nice plan which had been set was having a monkey wrench thrown into it. Because all these people going to register, Préval's rally, you know, drawing large number of people when the other 35-some candidate couldn't draw a crowd, all this made our great thinkers and our great strategists very nervous. So a lot of propaganda was made on, you know, saying how the insecurity was going to be very high and that it was going to be another massacre at the election, all that to discourage the people for voting. The election date was postponed 4 times. And really, on the eve of the election, nobody knew what was going to happen. But when the morning of February 7 came, I went to vote at about a 10-minute distance from my house. And I went early, 7 o'clock. The lines were so long that I decided, you know, I'm not going to stand in such a long line. I went back home. I returned to the polling station around 12. The line were just as long. I finally voted around 3 in the afternoon. But everywhere, people had woken up at 3 in the morning, walked 4 hours, and assaulted the voting station. Assaulted. Some people, you know, I've seen an old man climb a fence so that he would fall into the voting station and say, now, you know, I'm going to vote anyway because I'm inside, they can't put me out. You know? In Cité Soleil, they had put the voting station outside of Cité Soleil, yet people came in large number. But at 11, there was not anything going yet. The polling station were closed. The people took to the street to demand that the polling station be open, and they had to open them. And they voted en masse. It was the same all over the country. So the plan to rig the election upstream once again was foiled by the Haitian people. These masses of illiterate people showed a strategic mind that is incredible. It was foiled. They had reduced the number of polling stations from 12,000 that it was in the year 2000 down to 809 to filter the electorate, to make it more difficult in the poor neighborhood, in the countryside, you know. But in the fancy neighborhood, you had plenty of polling stations. Yet the people went and voted. And the minute they had voted, they knew how they had voted. The election results were supposed to be, you know, with this high-tech equipment and all, to be almost known in real time. But they said, like, in 3 days, all the results would come out. But it was taking a lot of time, because what was going on, after failing to rig the election upstream, they were trying to rig it downstream, you know, with all those computers and things. So after 5 days, they come out with partial result. After having counted 15% of the ballots, Préval was 62%. The next guy, around 11 or 12%. So the people said, this is okay, this is more or less the way we voted. But next result, at 50%, Préval is down to 54% of the vote. And also, there is something funny. 5% of the vote are blanks, and they are counted as valid ballots, which means that, for example, if you have 100 ballots and 5 blank ballots, you discount the blanks, you divide every candidate numbers by 100, it gives you, let's say, 52% for the first guy. If you count the blanks as valid, now you divide by 105, and 52% turns into 48 point something percent. And it looks fair, because every candidate will have his score divided by that 105, and everybody will have his score lowered in the same proportion. But the trick is not so much, you know, the guy who is in second place, he doesn't give a damn whether he has 12% or 10%. What he wants is to keep that second place. What is important, what is key, is to bring that first guy down under that magic line of 50% of the electorate plus one vote. Once you do that, you force a runoff. That's the law. You force a runoff, and in a runoff, anything is possible. The candidate that came in first, it doesn't matter. They set the clock back to zero. You know what I mean? And there is no third round. So if he loses in that runoff, that's it. And he has to accept the result as they are. But Préval was still at 54%. No runoff. Next result, he's at 49. But they were publishing that page who gave the result on the internet. And you know that program that calculates percentage and then makes a pie graph, right? It's the same program which does the calculation and the little design. So it's impossible to have a discrepancy between the pie graph and the numbers. But on the page published, and that people in the popular sector, because some of them, you know, have access to internet in the cyber cafes, they printed the page as it was, with the pie graph saying 52% and the numbers saying 49%. When people started pointing this out, the Electoral Council went back on the site and had that pie graph showing 49% just like the number, but the people had already printed the damn page. You know what I mean? So they started taking to the street. And they had the, you know, they had posted that page and they were explaining it to the journalists. When Préval went down to 48.73%, the people took to the street and would not let go. The best day was February the 13th, on the Monday following the election. You had even greater number of people than on the day of the election. And these were people who had voted and now were voting with their feet. And they said, no way you're going to steal my vote. There is no runoff. We voted once, we ain't voting twice. And these crowds have been described in some, not all, the news media as a violent mob. Not a single act of violence was perpetrated by this huge crowd, not a single one. In fact, the only act of violence that occurred was a Jordanian soldier from the UN shooting and killing a young man who was sporting a Préval t-shirt. The only act of violence. About 5,000 to 10,000 people coming from the poorest neighborhood of Port-au-Prince storm or gain entry, I would say, into the richest hotel in Haiti, a hotel that is on top of a very steep climb. They got in. They occupied the hotel from the yard up to the rooftop and all the floor in between, saying, because that's where the Electoral Council had its press room to announce the result. And when they were satisfied that no member of the Electoral Council was there, they just came out as they had came in, and not a single object was either broken or stolen. Imagine in any other country that 10,000 of the poorest people gain entry into the richest hotel. Tell me if you'd have this type of result, you know? And for me, looking at this scene, when you have this crowd reaching the hotel and the hotel gates are closed and the camera can show you both sides of that gate. On the inside, you have between 3 and 5 people, amongst which the owner of the hotel, trying to hold the gate against 5,000 to 10,000 people pushing. You know? This is completely pathetic. And this is the Haitian elite trying to hold back a people. And the rest is also interesting. When finally they did what reason commanded and gave up, opened the gate, did the masses come in and loot the place? Did they kill anybody? No, because that's not what they're after. They're not after their houses. They're not after their BMWs or their Porsches. All they want is for them to have their place in that society. It's for them to be able to send their kid to school, to be able to send their kid to the doctor when he's sick, so that their kid don't die from diarrhea anymore, something which is totally preventable. This is what the Haitian masses want. So they went into that hotel, spoke their piece, and went out. But as they were going out, they said, we might be back. So, as you see, despite all the might of the US, France, Canada, because Canada was very much involved in that high-tech election, you know, and that's the reason why Mr. Election Canada came back here and didn't have anything to say, because, you know, he was ashamed of having tried to rig the election and be beaten by a bunch of so-called ignorant people. Just same as Napoleon was totally shamed by losing a war to animals. This to confirm that the Haitian people cannot be stopped in their quest for democracy. So the Haitian elite must come to terms with that, sit down and negotiate, so that now, instead of privileges, they can have rights, just like everybody else. But so should the powers that have interfered so blatantly in Haitian internal affairs, and especially Canada, they should also come to the realization that Haiti is no danger for them, and that it is useless to try, useless, and also, you know, it's a crime, to try and impose their will and their government of their choice on the Haitian people. No way. You cannot impose democracy. You cannot export democracy. And these countries have to come to terms with that. If Canada is to help Haiti, it will do so through the elected leaders that the Haitian people themselves have chosen. That's the only way to go. It's not going to work otherwise. It will cause tremendous suffering, but it won't set the Haitian people back. They won't accept that. It's over. It's finished. Let's look forward, as they've been saying. Because, you know, all these guys, the Condoleezza Rice, the Pettigrew, etc., they think they can teach the Haitian people something about democracy, you know? And they say, stop looking backward, look forward. But the Haitian people have done nothing but looking forward. Those looking backward are the elite who think they can go back to a system where the masses are considered as zombies and only they have a say in the destiny of the country. It's not possible. Those who are looking backward are countries like the US, Canada, and France who think they can go back to the good old time, you know, when the ambassador in a small country would be like a proconsul. It's finished. It's over. It won't happen. You will create a lot of mess. You will destroy the image of your country in Haiti and in the West Indies, because Canada had a very good image in Haiti. Now it's gone. It's gone because of the insanity, of the stupidity, of the meanness of Canadian policy toward Haiti since 2003, or even a little before. Whereas in the first coup, Canada stood fast with Haiti. So I don't know what happened. Maybe you could explain it to me. But there's been a complete turnaround of Canadian policy toward Haiti. So I go back. Why should we bother? Why? There are many reasons why. Because, you see, Haiti is a canary. What happens to it tells you maybe 10 years in advance, maybe 100 years in advance, what's going to happen to you. They've been trying to impose government against the will of the people to Haiti. They will do that here also, if they haven't done so already. Because one thing also, the reason why we should look toward Haiti, we should develop a true solidarity with Haiti. We should try and learn more about the struggle that is going on down there, is because in our country, and I can say in our country because, you know, I'm Canadian, I'm Haitian by birth, but I'm Canadian by adoption, so I can say we don't know truly what democracy is. Most of us are totally, totally ignorant about, you know, how our society functions, you know, how decisions are made that affect our life. We are content to enjoy the completely, I'd say, artificial comfort that we have because, you know, our country is probably plundering other countries. So we get the crumbs and we're happy. You know, we put the iPod, we had the TV, and we think we have democracy. But democracy has been reduced here to the simple gesture of going or not going to the poll every so many years and collectively resign. We resign when we vote. That's what we do. We go and we say, we're not responsible anymore. These guys are responsible. We sell our responsibility, our power to change things by voting. It shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be like that. So, in the meantime, the government is using your tax money to send soldiers to Afghanistan, to send soldiers to Haiti. And when the polls say that, you know, 70% or 75% of a Canadian don't agree with that, the government say, bleep them, you know. You don't count anymore. Because, so maybe we should look at what the Haitians are doing. Because they make sure that they are counted and that they count. For them, democracy is not a luxury. It is a vital piece of the building, you know, of their dream. That's what it is. So, you see, being in solidarity with Haiti, trying to get a hold on Canada's policy, which is being done with your money, is very important. Yes, it's done out of an altruistic impulse. But I tell you, you gain for the fight that you have to wage here. Because things will not get better as people become more apathetic and give more of their power to this little group of politicians and, you know, the owners of the world. Already, you know, I came here in 68. And when I look at the country, I don't think it has progressed much. Canada, I always said, you know, if I have to go in exile, I'll come to Canada. Because I've lived here like 15 years. And I saw a country that was extremely different. I had lived in the state. It was extremely different. People interacted with each other. There was a solidarity. There was caring, for example, for the weak. And now there was a tremendous healthcare system, social security, and I come back now and I see a lot of that has been taken away. I see a lot of homeless people that I didn't used to see back then. I see that this is internal policy. But I look then at foreign policy. Where are the likes of Trudeau, of Diefenbaker, who used to have a foreign policy that had a minimum independence and autonomy? Now I see Canada aligning itself with the U.S. in foreign policy as it resembles more and more the U.S. in terms of its internal policy, its social policy. And all of this is eating away at the vision you have for your society. And if we don't look at what other people who are struggling are doing, when we wake up, it might be too late. So I'll end up by saying that this tour, it is to cut through the web of lies so that a people better informed can take the right decisions, and that Haiti gets from the Canadian people, the Haitian people get from the Canadian people, the solidarity, the friendship that they need and deserve.